Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
BT Sport Pods.
Hi, welcome to Michael Calvin's Football People. I'm joined by Miguel Delaney of The Independent and Dominic Fifield of The Athletic. I've been to Everton to see Sean Dyche. He was one of our first guests on this podcast and is back in his element in a nine-team relegation struggle. Of those teams, Leicester represent the dream. 5,000-1 winners of the Premier League. Now, the nightmare of the drop looms. Miggs, do you hold out much hope for them after another really damaging defeat?
If it was a relatively normal Premier League season, and I'm not sure you can even say that of one about 5 years ago, but going back that far, then no, because it just feels the direction of travel is clear, performances are bad, it's difficult to see where results and wins are coming from. But this season, just because it's so chaotic and any sort of win, even the flukiest of wins, can suddenly change the entire profile of the ball. I mean, even if you look at yesterday's game, as we went into the final minutes, one goal could have taken Leicester into 14th. Instead, they conceded one and everything looks much worse. That is why there is still some hope. But if you're actually looking in terms of their performances and what they do next, there's an awful lot less.
What about the timing of the managerial change, Dom? Okay, winless run now stretches to 8 after that defeat on Tuesday night. Should they have taken the decision on Brendan Rodgers a little earlier, perhaps? Because they're almost stuck betwixt and between here, aren't they? You know, in handing things over to a relatively minor member of Rodgers' backroom staff, Adam Sadler, I'm not sure what they're trying to achieve.
No, I'm with you on that. The international break was the moment I thought a lot of clubs would act. Some of them did. Tottenham eventually, Palace effectively appointed some, Roy Hodgson in that window. And that would have given a new man, a completely fresh set of eyes, a chance to assess the squad over what's effectively 10 days ahead of the 10-game run-in. Leicester's decision to get rid of Brendan Rodgers after that loss at Selhurst Park at the weekend, I mean, that just shows there was no plan. There is no grand strategy here. You can't assume that Mick Sowell and Adam Sadler are going to do anything different to Brendan Rodgers. I mean, there is an argument that you have somebody in the way that Chelsea have with Bruno Saltor. That's just almost a bit of continuity, a slightly fresher voice, but a bit of continuity for a while ahead of an appointment. Although Chelsea are in a very different scenario to Leicester City, but to have no firefighter lined up to come in immediately and take up the reins is very, very risky, I'd have thought. But probably an indication of the financial situation at Leicester, the sort of constraints that Rodgers probably struggled with towards the end of his tenure there. But also the dilemma that club is in. I mean, they go down and the finances are going to be a hell of a lot worse. It just feels as if they need an experienced man, a Benitez-type manager, just to come in and just see if they can just steady the ship. Because it only needs two, three wins, and you, as Mig says, and you're well out of trouble, albeit for a couple of weeks. And the one thing about Leicester that they have that that really none of those other teams have in that bottom half is they do have goals in the team. They have scored 40 this season, and you just feel as if they could just sort out the defence a bit. And having watched them on Saturday, they really need to sort out the defence a bit. But they might be able to tweak things and survive.
Mm. Because what we're looking at here is the dynamics of the managerial market, if you like, Miguel. I know this is a knee-jerk view, but isn't someone of Graham Potter's style and personality and strategic approach really well suited to a club like Leicester? But the reality is he's probably not going to be around at least until the summer because he must be burnt out.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one side of it. The other side of it is that as good as Potter is a coach and as well suited he is to Leicester, is 10 games that could well see the champions from 7 years ago relegated really the best context for him to try and impose that? Also, I mean, there's actually a risk there for Potter as well. Even though such a situation shouldn't affect his managerial career, given the kind of constraints and context we're talking about. But then suddenly he could be facing up to, and these sort of perceptions are important in careers, we could be facing up to a season for him that has really almost transformed his profile. One that started with, he beats Manchester United at Old Trafford on what seems an obvious upward trajectory, as he's kind of one of the brightest coaches in European football, gets the Chelsea job, loses it after what was a pretty dull 6 months, and then for that to end with relegation with a club like Leicester, who really shouldn't be in this position, and it wouldn't be through his fault, but still, it wouldn't be seen as reflecting that well. And so I can completely see Graham Potter, as well as needing a break, which he should take, and it's probably arguable that more managers should do that, just even the situation should put him off. But even from that, as you mentioned there, isn't it incredible we're in the situation where we have a team that won the Champions League a year and a half ago and could well win it again this season, a team going for a second successive Champions League qualification in Spurs, and then Leicester, who were champions 7 years ago, all of them, it's not even like they have caretaker managers in, as Dom has mentioned, or someone like Goose Hiddink. They've actually got these standings, two of them with no previous managerial experience at all. It's an incredible situation for, as is so often described, the best league in the world and the wealthiest anyway.
The other thing to bear in mind with Leicester is the sheer number of players that are out of contract at that club come the summer. It's a real issue that. I mean, some of them aren't even featuring. Yuri Tielemans has been conspicuous in his absence of late. But how does a manager, even an experienced manager like Rodgers, hope to motivate a team of players that know that if they go out and make that extra stretch or make that extra tackle and risk an ACL, then they're out of contract in the summer and facing 9 months out and their entire careers on the line. It's a really difficult one motivating that when there has to be an inkling in all these players' heads as to what's happening next. It will be there. It will be sitting on their shoulder wondering what their future is and where they're going to be playing their football and whether that affects their commitment this season. I know Roy Hodgson, when he was speaking about his last spell at Palace, and he had I think it was 12 or 13 players out of contract in the summer, and Palace were safe, but he said it was a real issue trying to motivate that team because none of them knew really what their futures held and that they all suspected it wasn't at that club. And I imagine it's the same problem with Leicester. It's a real perfect storm.
That's a really good point, actually. I hadn't thought of that. You know, I suppose in the most immediate term, Leicester have got Bournemouth at home on Saturday. Migs, this is the classic cutthroat game, isn't it? Given Bournemouth have also slipped back into the bottom three.
Yeah, and to be honest, actually, we should really get used to these because just given that, well, at least 9 of the Premier League are in this, there's going to be at least one of these every single week. And this is maybe the first, I mean,
good.
You know.
I love it.
It's started this week. <don't>. But Palace should be, you'd think they'd have enough now. You think Everton would have enough. But until, I suppose, they're mathematically clear, they're still in it. And yeah, and I read a point where actually it genuinely is unpredictable. And it does feel a little bit, that half of the Premier League is almost like a vision of what the whole competition could be if you didn't have this modern history of kind of 6 clubs or so pulling away from the rest, because it really is just so congested. And yeah, and it's that is one where it's hard to know what to expect. But I mean, given Bournemouth have actually been quite decent lately, you would think they actually should have enough for Leicester and could really make things difficult for Leicester from there. But again, just with the way this season has gone, with the way the bottom half has gone, I wouldn't exactly be putting too much stock even in that.
Well, with the average tenure of the Premier League manager, 1 year and 241 days, these are extremely insecure times, let's put it like that. Steve Cooper is hanging on to his job at Nottingham Forest by a thread. But how unfair is that, Don? Because if you look at it, what more could he have done? He inherited a team at the bottom of the Championship, somehow put together a Premier League team from 30 random strangers, and now he's basically, you know, next neck on the block.
Yeah, look, it's grossly unfair. I think the very fact that Forest go into the last 9 games of their season still in contention to stay in the division is testament to the job that he's done there, because they have no right to do that, really. They had so many loan players that helped them get out of the division, and bearing in mind, as you say, when he took over, they were rock bottom of the Championship, not the Premier League, the Championship. He did an incredible job last season to get a bit of a hodgepodge of a team of loanees and some very good talented youngsters up into the division. And given the sheer number of players that have been through the door at the City Ground this time round, 29, 30 recruits, whatever it is, for them to be in contention and still in with a chance of staying in the division is a real indication of how good he is. They were always going to struggle. Their run of games coming up is horrible. I mean, you don't look at them and think it doesn't smack of revival anytime soon. So it's going to be a real slog. But the very nature of the Premier League means that, you know, if they can pick up points in their games with, I don't know, maybe Southampton at home, they've got Palace still to play away, there'll be others in that group who are sort of mid-table by the time that they play them, even Chelsea, then they could still stand a chance of staying up. What is a new bloke going to do? What's a new fella coming in and taking over that squad going to do? There's no guarantee that that's going to suddenly kickstart a revival either. He's going to have to get to know a squad that are still getting to know each other. I mean, I hope that he's given until the end of the season at the very, very least. I fear he won't be, but I hope he is, and that he clings on, and that Forest prolong their battle to stay in the division, because they've been a real breath of fresh air this term.
But Easter's reputation for being decisive is likely to be highlighted, isn't it, Migs? When you think of it, Forest are at Villa on Saturday. Hardly an auspicious time to visit Villa Park. The appointment of Unai Emery is, you know, almost the exemplar of getting the change right, isn't it?
Well, that's it, yeah. Villa are an indication of how important it is to get the timing right as well. I mean, I think there's all sorts of statistics now. Duncan Alexander did one in The Athletic about how the later you go in the season as regards a managerial change, the less effect it has. And I feel like that if Forrest were to get rid of Cooper, it feels like it would, I mean, beyond the fact that we're talking about one of the best coaches in the league, and the fact it would be absurd to look at that Forest situation and think Cooper is in any way one of the problems. But if they were to get rid of him, it's difficult to see how it would have that much of an effect. I mean, if they really wanted someone, a different approach or some sort of different impact, just to kind of, from the change of mood that a different manager can bring, the time to do it is really when Villa did it with Emery or even 2 months after that. Now, it would just feel like one of those desperate moves that is beginning to pretty much define this season. And certainly, I mean, if they were to do it, what sums it up is, it feels like Forrest have a lot better chance of going to Villa and getting a result if Cooper is there. If he's not, it's hard not to see him just being easily picked off by an Emery side or on really good form. But I suppose, as regards to Easter being decisive, and the only reason that may not be so influential this season is, again, because of how wide the net is this season as regards relegation and the teams that could potentially suck in. And also because we're that bit earlier. I mean, there's still 10 games to go. There's still over a quarter of the campaign left. That is a lot. Sorry, 9 now. It's still a quarter left. That is a lot of football still to be played. With the World Cup, I mean, it's something we're actually not really talking about anymore. But it still feels like it's having a lot of unanticipated effects, maybe unseen effects as well, but that is influencing the situation. There's still a lot of football to be played, but it's impossible, I think, for us to be better served if their football was played under Cooper.
Don, close to home, Crystal Palace, they've got the biggest breathing room of the nine.
Was that 3 points?
3 points, yeah. Don't sort of waste it. But are you more confident that Palace will have enough to stay up? You know, they've got Leeds at the weekend, which obviously is a difficult game.
Well, look, the next 5 games are Leeds, Southampton, Everton, Wolves and West Ham. I mean, those are the matches that Palace need to glean the points from to ensure they stay in the division. And beyond that, they've still got Bournemouth and Forest to play at home. So it's in their hands. I don't think one last minute win against Leicester City makes you safe in this division. I mean, I know everybody's sort of saying, oh, well, they'll be fine now. But I mean, that is a second win in 18 games in all competitions and the first of the calendar year. You'd hope it's the springboard for better things. And I think Roy Hodgson, judging by the reaction of certainly Ray Lewington, who sprinted off down the touchline as if he was a 35-year-old at the end of the game, is quite remarkable. They appreciate the significance of it, but it is just the start, and it has to be the start of 3, 4, 5 weeks of improved results and performances. The one thing about Hodgson is I do think that they will... He has got a good record against teams that are below him in the table. I mean, usually that's from a position of mid-table. I suppose that's where Palace are, actually, 12th. They have been forever and they always will be. But you'd like to think that he will pick up a few points and maybe a few wins just to keep them clear. The big unknown, of course, is the extent of Wilfred Zaha's injury, because he was excellent against Leicester and looked like a player revived for the period he was on the pitch. But, you know, he looked as if his groin popped, and that could be anything between, you know, 3 weeks to the end of the season. So we'll wait with bated breath for Roy's assessment on Friday.
OK, well, Leeds were the biggest midweek winners, weren't they, Migs? I think it was 5 places they've gone up the table after beating Forest. 10 points from 6 games under Javi Garcia. Really important wins, Southampton, Wolves and Forest, since he replaced Jesse Marsh. We didn't really know that much about him when he was at Watford, although the fact that he actually survived from just over a year at Watford tells you that he must be fairly decent.
Yeah, and got into a cup final. Well, I don't think we think the result of that cup final, no reflection on the excellent job he did. I interviewed him in that period, and I suppose there's a bit of a link because he's from the same area of Spain as my mother. So he's a really humble guy, and I think a very good manager. It's quite interesting because I think that Leeds United managerial search was quite chaotic, and they wanted Arnie Slot. But it's possible, and I suppose this actually sort of goes against everything we said at the last half hour or so, but that is maybe one rare case of it potentially working out, because they just got exactly the right man. I mean, I think immediately you can see the difference. I was at their match against Arsenal on Saturday, and even though it ended up 4-1, that's more about Arsenal. But before that opening goal, which was quite, I suppose, not a contentious penalty, but came from a rash decision from Ayling, they're giving Arsenal problems, and you can see that there's a better shape about them. I think they're going to be a lot harder to beat. And from what he's done so far, from what he's done at Watford and at Osasuna in Spain, I'd be quite confident the Leeds have enough to say, maybe not completely comfortably given how this season is going, but I think they've got a bit more about them now, true Gracia, and also through the running of that team, than a lot of the other clubs around them.
Well, with things so tight at the bottom, there's a premium on experience, unity and organisation. Those three qualities are being demonstrated by Everton under Sean Dyche. No surprise there, then. We spoke about the specifics of survival.
Well, welcome, Sean. Maybe welcome back, because the last time we spoke was sort of mid-August. You were beginning actively to look at your options and opportunities. What were the lessons that you drew from that time, which obviously culminated in you coming here?
I don't know about lessons that culminated in me actually coming here, but things I reflected on about, you know, my time, well, at both clubs, Watford and Burnley, but obviously Burnley with more depth because of the years I was there. Reflecting on thoughts of what you do next, not just what comes next, but what you do next. You know, what are the things that you keep? What are the things that you change? Making sense of that. Along with having a rest as well, stepping away from everything, which I did for a number of months and enjoyed that in the right way, you understand. Not because I was demotivated remotely, just because I felt that it was right and I took advice and people say, get away from it, just switch off for a while, you know, to get that real desire and hunger. Like I say, not that it wasn't there, but it sometimes needs, you know, the spark again and the fire to burn brighter. So really quite a lot going on. But you know yourself, the thing with hindsight is that you probably look more in depth now than when it was going, you know, when I first came out. When you first came out, you're just seeing your family and your kids and you're seeing your mates and you're taking a few games in, have a few trips, and you're not overthinking it. Whereas when I look back now, and as you know, did a lot of Zoom work with different people, different companies, some coaches as well, a few visits. And then you actually think, you reflect back and think, actually, I did quite a lot in that sort of 8 month period, you know.
Were there any specific things that you bring into action here now?
No, not really. I think the strange thing about coming here now, I think it needed a certain stripping back, as I call it, you know, partly sort of, I call it embracing the past, building a future, or rebuilding a future, because the past is vital and it's valid. And the connection that a lot of the fans would have with the years of the past, and the older fans, of course, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, they're valuable times and great values, I think, throughout a club. And I just felt they diluted a little bit. It's not they weren't there, just a little bit, you know, just almost like squeezed aside a bit, and it become very, and we've got to play this way, got to play that way, which obviously football is like that now. And I felt some of the basics were missing, you know, in the how I look at teams and what they do. And really kind of spoke to the players about it very openly and said, look, I think we've got to get back down to the real nitty-gritty of what it is as a team, and then layer upwards rather than sort of playing with a certain way and then layering it backwards. So I said the base, as I call it, had to be put in place. So really focusing on that. To do that, sorry, in answer to your question, I don't think I needed to reflect too much on my learnings. I think I knew that was important, and I knew it was valuable, and I knew it needed to be in place in the way that I work, certainly. So there's no question mark about previous managers or any of that. The way that I work, that has to be intact. So, like I said, I came in with that knowledge already imprinted on me, and then it was about transferring it into the staff that I've inherited and the players, of course, and slowly but surely that's been growing.
There's a watchword of your time here already, relentless. Explain what actually that means in a football sense.
Yeah, to me, it was something that started when I was working with young players at Watford, because when the young players are very malleable, as you can imagine, you know, they don't know what they don't know. So I was trying to teach them about professional standards, key core values, and mentality. And then, of course, teaching them the game. But people, in my opinion, there's a lot of trainers out there, and trainers use PowerPoints and do sessions. I'm a coach, so I coach the people as well. Now, that's a valuable thing for me. So I was instilling them in some of the mentality of being a professional. I was a professional for 20 years, had my ups and downs, successes and failures, bit of a journeyman, but I learned a lot through them 20 years at different levels, of course, different standards of clubs, different size of clubs. So some of the things I started reflecting on weren't necessarily 4-4-2, 4-3-3. It was about what's the underbelly, what's the underlying ingredients of making a young player or helping a young player to be the best they can be. And that's where things like relentlessness comes from. It's relentless in what you do, your pursuit of being the best, relentless on a daily basis, relentless in the details, relentless on the training pitch, relentless with anything you can do to make the best. And inevitably, as a team, then we've got to all be relentless, because things can change you all very, very quickly. So over a 96, 97 minute game, just stay with it. Just keep doing everything you can do to affect it. And don't be surprised if you do that when it does get affected. Mm. So that's where the thinking come from.
Yeah, so it's sort of keep hanging on to the horse, the fucking Bronco, basically.
Yeah, it sounds about right. Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of noise about any club involved in a, you know, that's what is generally termed a relegation struggle. You know, now pressure is applied collectively, but how players deal with that strain is personal. You know, as a manager, how attuned do you have to be to the signs of maybe one or two individuals feeling the strain a little bit?
Well, part of the idea, one of the big things I talk to the players about and the staff about, is automaticity. So to get to automatic behaviours, you have to do them all the time. And once you get an automatic behaviour, if you know how to do things and you deliver them all the time so they normalise, well, then the idea of pressures, ups and downs dissipates slightly because you know that you're going to deliver it because you're delivering it all the time. So I really work on that basis on a daily basis. You know, we structure and we plan and we deliver on a daily basis so that when it is pressurised situation, you need it, you are ready to go. So that's one of the big things. And if you like, if we get the structure and the basics and the core right and we're all agreed on that, well, then you don't have to go in thinking about it. That's all part, which allows you the time to focus on what you need to.
So
it
becomes instinctive.
Yeah, and like I say, if you can normalise behaviours, that being football behaviours, then when tough times, or great times, by the way, pressure comes in many ways. You know, I've had top pressure when we've been at the top getting promoted to the Premier League, as you know, and getting into Europe, when every point's a prisoner for a different reason. But it's still a pressure. So these habits and these behaviours are valuable anyway. They're not just about whether you're at the bottom or the top. They're about good behaviours all of the time. And then I just think once you've got that base to rely upon, then you can go in with a bit more assured thinking that, you know, you are ready. And it's a fact. You know, your daily habits are delivering the fact you are ready. So if there is some form of pressure, we know what we're doing. We do it all the time. And here we go again. The whistle blows and we're ready. Now, of course, there'll be some detail around that. You can imagine flexibility. But that base that I talk about, that is part of it. Working properly all of the time until behaviours become automatic.
How do you manage yourself so that, you know, you remain fresh and focused? You know, does someone in your job need an escape valve? In other words, like an interest outside the game, so it just doesn't become...
Yeah, I think you do. I think varying people have varying forms of that. Mine is actually pretty simplistic. I like a beer now and again. I like a game of golf. I like seeing my family and my kids. I like gigs. That's a good release for me because gigs you can disappear. I was at a gig the other night. I went to watch The Damned. I disappeared in the background and then disappeared out again. And no one bothered me. No one even mentioned that I was there. I think one person who was literally standing next to me. That was it. That's a good release for me.
Stuart Pearce, was it?
No, but he is going, actually. No, he's going to watch Spirit of Destiny in a couple of... tomorrow, actually, in Manchester, the Ritz, but I can't do that one night before a game. So that is a relief for me. But pretty simplistic stuff. I like my music, as I said. I like travelling, but obviously that's not so easy. You know, and so it's pretty much... The other thing, you know, what you forget is years of doing it. You know, like any job, the more years you do it, the more you handle the ups and downs, the ins and outs, the workload, the pressure. You delegate better as well. I found that as you get older and you trust people more, as long as they're aligned with you, you trust them more, so you delegate better. I think you know how to manage yourself in the sense of your energy levels, energy for what part of the moment in time is the most important. Media now, you know, media's an energy level you need, because if you lose focus, You can say one wrong word and then that makes a big story nowadays out of nothing, because there's so many different media avenues. So I think it's years of experience, or more and more years of experience, mixed with some pretty common sense stuff. Taking a rest when I need to, delegating when I need to, and just enjoying some of the things outside of football when I can, more than when I need to. Sometimes you need something and you can't get it, but it's nice when I can.
What about a group culture and the importance of senior players, the sort of players who set personal and professional standards for the rest of the group? How important?
Yeah, I think important. I think, you know, the early adopters, as we call it, often, not always, are the older players who have been maybe a bit more rounded, a bit more travelled. They've learned themselves, of course, and they've learned some of the things they shouldn't have been doing and they should have been doing, and now they're a bit older, they reflect back. And therefore, they're a little bit more, not really open-minded, a little bit more professionally minded to what the role they deliver and what the group has to deliver. So I think there's that, and I think that's an important thing to have from older players. And the mutual respect, you know, you've got to respect them as well. You know, there's players who have done quite a lot in the game. You weren't the obvious one being Seamus. You know, Seamus has been here, I think it's 14 seasons. Throughout his 14 seasons, ups, downs, ins, outs, hero zero, highs of the club, tough times of the club. He's seen all of that sort of stuff. And yet still an immaculate pro, still going strong, still sending the right messages, the right vibes about everything that we're trying to achieve. Very respectful of the outgoing manager as well. You know, he was the first to say, we haven't done our bit, which, you know, they spoke to me about the players, felt that they could have done more. All of them things go into the melting pot. So therefore, your older players, I think, deserve the respect they're due. Equally, they often show a bit more mutual respect because they're a bit older and wiser and a bit more travelled, some of them. So therefore, they've been in the ups and downs and they know what's good practice. They know it's maybe not.
So you're looking for a self-governing dressing room in many ways.
I think it helps. I always think you have to lay down the culture and the environment to the staff, first of all, the team behind the team. That's really important to me because they often send the right tone and the right messages as well. And then within the group, once they understand, I think you've got to be clear. I give them clear guidelines on what my expectations, both from a professional behaviour point of view and a professional performance point of view. I lay that down very, very early, and we have some negotiables and non-negotiables, some serious stuff, some small stuff. And then really over time, you look for other players, you know, you look for key signs. Are the players now taking responsibility for that? And obviously every manager of every kind, I would imagine, through business as well, I'd speak to a few businesses, nirvana is when they do start taking ownership and responsibility and they do start demanding off of each other without you always demanding. You know, they do within the camp. And I think that's an important factor.
Mm. With those senior players, you mentioned Seamus Coleman. You know, obviously, he's one of those players who has the DNA of the club in his blood, basically. Another player that obviously you know well, James Tarkowski, he'd always struck me as one of those players. I did James Milner a couple of weeks ago. James Milner was going to be a coach and a manager. You know, that's clear as day. Someone like James, I could see actually moving into that direction as well. I don't know whether that's a misleading impression, but you know him very well. That relationship between you two, how important was that in almost like the transitional phase? Because you know what footballs are like. They'd have been all on to him. You know, his phone would have blown up when you got the job. What's he like? All that stuff.
Yeah, probably more so Tarky because of the character he is. You know, Dwight as well, but he's quite a quieter character. So the players probably wouldn't have gone straight to Dwight. It probably would have been Tarky. Keno a little bit as well, because Keno's been here a longer time. A lot of respect for him within the group. A well-liked figure. But yeah, Tarky's probably just coming out of working with him for a long time. I imagine that I would like to think it'd have been a fair assessment of the way that I work. He knows the staff as well. Steve Stone and Ian Warner have come in, and Mark Howard. I would like to think he'd give a fair view. I would think he would have told them some of the obvious things and some of the myths that they've heard as well, and maybe corrected a few of them. I must say, you know, in reference to Tarky, I don't always like talking about individuals, but in a tough season at the end of my tenure at Burnley, he was absolutely fantastic. His contract was running out. He was playing like with every inch of his life to change the team around, the fortunes around. And I respect that. That's not easy. You know, when your contracts run out, he could have been looking after himself. He wasn't. He was doing everything he could to look after the team. And I take great value in him as a person for doing that, because it's not easy when things are not going well and you know there's an exit for you. Because it's pretty obvious Tarky was going to get a pretty good move, I would imagine. I certainly thought he would. And he got a good move to a good club like Everton, and he deserved it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Michael Keane there. You know, is that classic case of the experienced player who comes back. What did you see in him that others didn't, perhaps? But also, what went through your head when he scored that equaliser against Spurs? Because, you know, you talked about the culture of the club. The place was going nuts. Yet, when the whistle went, you had the mask on, you know, you observed the professional formalities with, you know, the other set of coaches. What's going through in your head there? There must have been a degree of huge satisfaction and probably a realisation of what this club's about.
Well, firstly, and more importantly with Keno, is look, you have ups and downs as a player. There's not always an exact moment which occurs, but he's a bit older, he's a bit wiser, a bit more rounded than when he left me before. I spoke to him clearly. He's very trusting of me, you can imagine. Mm. So I spoke to him very clearly, very honestly, as I do, and said, look, I don't think you're sharp enough. I think you've got to get you fitter. We've got to get you stronger. And I said, spoke to him about a few details in training that I reminded him of, that some of his things that I used to notice when he wasn't quite playing well that were lacking. So he sharpened up on them. Took a risk because Conor Coady is a fantastic pro and doing well, and took a chance on Keno, went in at Arsenal. People are saying, oh yeah, we got beat 4-0. I wasn't looking for whether it's his fault or not. I was looking for, you know, are you ready? Or can you handle it physically? Played well the next game and he's played well since. So that was these are fine margin calls, you know, when you're changing people like Keane over Conor Coady. And then going on to myself and his goal, fantastic strike. He is a very good finish. There's a standard joke amongst the players about his finishing, the quality of it. And then the idea at the end of the game is, look, it's another point on the board. There's nothing done. There's nothing achieved. I've just always been like that. You know, players used to like laugh at me. When I used to play, I was captain at clubs and I remember one chairman actually asking me deliberately, why don't I go and clap all the fans and all that? I said, it's just not really my bag. I said, I respect them. And I used to play, shake hands with the nearest opponent, jog off. Because I was like, yeah, well, it's another day. We've got whatever. You know, in the Premier League, 38 of these. So it doesn't mean I'm not feeling it, by the way. Of course I'm feeling the respect of a group that's just given their lot to win a game, on this occasion got a draw. The energy of a fan base that's been incredible since I got here. Of course it's there, and I respect it. But it's just not authentic to me to be running up and down the line Snyder nominees and all that. That's not authentic to me. It's not the behaviour that I think is appropriate for me personally. I'm not judging anyone else as a manager of a football club. And I try and withhold myself respect as well as the respect for the staff that are opposite, you know, because I just think that there's a moment in time when that, you know, things can happen in the coaches' areas because people are sort of doing them weird actions that kind of wind people up. That's not my bag. I just try and act authentically to me. And that's what I'm like. It's another point on the board. The work isn't done. The job isn't done. We've got more points to get on the board, I assure you. So I just stay focused on the bigger picture.
Now, you know, we do talk about culture a lot, don't we? And obviously, there's a very strong sense of identity here. You're a club builder by inclination. Is that a really good marriage between your inclinations and this club's opportunity?
I'm about to say yes, by the way.
Oh, yeah,
but at the end of the day, look, there's no defining moment, and there's no, not defining moment, sorry, there's no exact moment when you think it's all done or joined. But I think we're on the right pathway. I think, you know, this is a different kind of, the building at Burnley was a different kind of building. It was building the structure and everything, you know, building training grounds and the like. This has got all of that. This is, like I say, I was mentioning, you know, respect the past, the sort of build a future. So it's sort of rebuild a future. I don't mean rebuild it because it's massively broken. I just mean it maybe needed an inner building of people, not so much the structure, not so much the size of the club. Obviously, you'll know there's a new stadium coming and all them things. Mm. Different kind of building. I think it was a rebuilding inside the mentality, the work ethic, the belief, the connection with the fans, you know, the connection as with the blue part of a city that is deeply bound in football culture, as you know. So that's what I felt was appropriate. Of course, as you know, you've known me a long time, I'm not naive, you're still going to win games and you've got to try and provide a brand and a style that is appropriate and accepted. But underneath all that, what's actually the thing that makes a football club? What are the key core values that you represent? Well, first of all, in my opinion, you represent yourself, the staff and the players, but you also represent the people. Therefore, I think Liverpool as a city has an earthiness. The Blues of the city have an earthiness. They have a connection with the club, the history of the club. And I just think that is a very, very powerful thing. And I think it deserves to be respected. In modern society, sometimes them things get almost pushed away a little bit. I don't think they should be. I think that is a massive building block for this football club to continue onwards, whether I'm here or not. And I just think I'm trying to revive the belief and the sentiment and the heartbeat of a club whilst adding in the modern technology, analysis, sports science, style, hopefully, brand, but not forgetting about the heartbeat. And I think that's really, really important at all clubs, but particularly certain clubs and particularly Everton Football Club.
Okay. As a final point, it's been another tumultuous week for your profession, putting it mildly. The rates of attrition are becoming much more punishing. I saw a stat the other day, the average tenure in Premier League management, 1 year and 241 days. Does that sort of time frame influence the way managers do their job?
Well, I think similar but different point that you were just bringing up, in the sense that, so on the one hand, right, so I've been told in the past I'm being naive because I'm trying to build the club and what it stands for. I was told that many, many times. You're not going to get long enough, so therefore don't try and do that. Just try and win enough games or whatever. And I get that thought thinking because, as you said, the stats almost suggest that is going to happen. But then you've still got to be true to yourself. You know, what's your way of working? Did I come into Everton Football Club thinking, oh, well, let's see if I can be there for 1 year and 241 days that you just said? No, I didn't. I come in going open-mindedly, right, can I play my part? First of all, in being a custodian. Secondly, building it and looking after it. And thirdly, being successful for a longer period. Well, to do that, I've got to lay down the things that I think are very, very important and then layer up on top of that. So that's what I'm trying to do. I don't look at it like, oh, well, the stats say you're only going to be there 18 months or whatever. I don't look at it like that. I look like, right, OK, what can we build to make a difference and let's see where it begins to take us? So that's the way I look at it. I don't put timescales on it. Balance to my words there are that the stats and the facts do show you. So I do, on the other hand, know coaches who just go to football clubs and go, no, I just coach the team and I work hard at it. If it goes wrong, that's the way it goes. If it goes well, then that's the way it goes. That's just not for me. You know, I believe there's more to it than that. Affect the people, affect their performance, affect the staff, affect the feel, affect the club, affect the whole group of people to get their noses pointed in the right direction. That's my way of working.
Right. And as a final point, when you look at the qualities that are almost undervalued in a hire and fire culture that we've just spoken about, your qualities are very, very distinct, aren't they? What will tell you that you're on the right track here? In other words, what would success look like here? Obviously, you know, staying up's the initial.
Yeah, immediate success. Mm. But there's been some form of success that I hold dear already, and that's why I just spoke about the alignment. I think there is beginning to be a real strong connection or reconnection between the staff, the players, the fans, the feel, the whole, what it is to be an Evertonian. And it's not fixed yet by any means, but you can feel it. You walk in the stadium, you can sense it. That's a win in itself, because it's fair to say when I got here, the noise wasn't the same. So that's one form of a win. But obviously to support that, you've got to win physically. You've got to literally win, or certainly win enough to make sure you safeguard in the Premier League. So then you build another connection on top of that. So there's been some small wins already. There's been some actual wins, as in on the pitch. And now it's about keep working to bring it all together. It's never truly fixed forever, but I believe there's a healing process that's going on. The team, the fans, the feel of a club. And I think it's definitely happening. And now it's just, we've got to continue to find consistencies to make it happen.
Mm. So survive and thrive. Thanks for your
time.
Like
it. Your words, not mine, but very good ones.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers, thanks.
An excellent appointment for what will probably be a two-phase job. Survive and then thrive.
Yeah, I mean, the immediate task is to stay in the division, and they've already got, I think, 12 points under his management. And you can see some of the qualities that his team have demonstrated from the first game against Arsenal, where they were back to their sort of bullying best, which you'd expect from we've seen it before from the sort of Burnley team. I know they didn't always get great results against the top six, but they had the reputation and they certainly had the capabilities of bullying teams and exploiting set pieces, etc. But even in recent weeks, almost more impressive has been this resilience and defiance again that had been sort of lacking from Everton through that horrible period in the middle of the season where they just were losing every week and everything seemed so listless. And you know, the point at Chelsea, okay, Chelsea aren't what they were, but to come back from behind twice at Chelsea and do what they did was really, really impressive with the last minute goal as well from Ellis Sims. And then against Spurs on Monday, even when they had 10 men, Everton, and they were playing against 11, they just felt as if there was only one team that was going to score the next goal. Tottenham were awful in possession. I don't think I mean they're plumbing new depths at some of their passing in that game. But when you have a centre half meandering forward and pinging one in the way that Michael Keane did later on, it just makes you the sense growing that we're going places now. We're a different beast. Four games unbeaten. They look far better now than that sort of that mess that got hammered at Arsenal under Dyche, actually, back in the beginning of March. And it's us against the world at Everton yet again. It's a sort of revisiting last season, maybe not with the pitch invasions and the general sense of madness, but the world is out to get them, the Premier League's out to get them, the ownership, they hate the ownership. But the team is giving them a bit of defiance out on the pitch to latch onto and to sustain them through this run into a very difficult season. And Sean Dyche epitomises and personifies that. And yeah, kick on from the summer, absolutely, if you can, because it's not going to be easy given the issues around that club. But Dyche's reputation will be enhanced by what he's done at Everton, I suspect.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose it does highlight, Migs, the importance of senior players, you know, the restoration of Michael Keane and also the inspiration of Seamus Coleman, who seems to have you know, the DNA of the club running through him.
Yeah, no, this was, to be fair with Coleman, there was a famous clip of Lampard kind of talking him up in front of the squad. And I suppose you could say that that sort of spirit was important in keeping Everton up last season. I mean, that shouldn't be overlooked with Lampard as well. Actually, I suppose in terms of Lampard, this maybe shouldn't be overlooked either. The factor's obviously different, but he did a better job at Chelsea than Graham Potter did. at least if you kind of, Brandon, I suppose, might be a surprise to a lot of people in the way we discuss these things. But the bare facts are there, even if obviously the factors are different. But yeah, he lent on players like Coleman, if not Michael Keane. And that was important to last season. And Dyche, who's even more attuned to that sort of, or to engendering that sort of mentality and that sort of defiance than Lampard is, well, he's getting even more out of Everton. And that's the thing, I suppose. That's what's immediately noticeable with this side. They're suddenly very well organised and hard to break down. And again, I actually think to a greater degree than Javi Gracia, maybe comparable to Crystal Palace, Everton are one of those who, because haven't been right in the middle of it for so long, could just create a little bit of a cushion between themselves and the rest. So, I mean, there, even though it was 8 or 9 at the moment, I think you could feasibly see Palace, Everton and Leeds just getting away. But with this season, I mean, who's to know? But the one thing we do know is that Dyche, at the very least, is usually a guarantee of that sort of effect.
Well, they certainly got winnable fixtures against Fulham, who seem to be imploding. Palace, with respect, Dom, and Leicester after Saturday's game at Old Trafford. They're also at home to Bournemouth in the last game of the season if they need a get out of jail card. So really, survival's in their own hands, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But then you could argue that for all of them. I mean, Mick's saying there that he sees Everton, Palace and Leeds all pulling away. Well, they can't, because they all play each other. So they can't all pull away.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the intrigue around this division. Everybody sort of looks at the run-ins and say, well, you know, there's some winnable games there. And I mean, as a Palace fan, I've been doing that all season, believe me. But the reality is that those teams, your opposition, will be targeting those fixtures against Palace, against Everton, against Leeds as an opportunity amidst tougher, using the older inverted commas, fixtures. So it's going to be intriguing. But Everton's home form will go a long way, and the way that they can make it intimidating. I was at Goodison Park last season when Lampard and his team whipped up a frenzy in the run, and it is an intimidating place to go. The issue they've got is that they don't score goals, but then that's an issue that all those teams bar Leicester really have got. I think Everton's leading goal scorer is Damari Gray with 4. I mean, it's not that is an issue. They're never going to, you know, wipe the floor with a team, so they're going to be tense matches throughout. But when you've got like a Tarkowski, you've got a revived Keane, and you've got that resilience, a bit of a know-how at the back, Jordan Pickford, England's, you know, stellar goalkeeper in there, I think you probably grind out a few more results than some of those teams around you. But look, it's changing every week. It only needs a few rushes of blood like Abdoulaye Doucouré's thrusting a hand in Harry Kane's face for the whole landscape to change again, because, you know, Doucouré is actually, I think, the leading goal scorer for Sean Dyche at Everton with 2. And now he's going to be absent for 3 games. You know, if you lose a couple of players, if you lose a Tarkowski, then suddenly they don't look quite as assured. So that adds to this sense of drama that is going to, I want to say, sustain us over the last 10 weeks, but it's actually just going to make life hell.
There, folks, is the voice of experience. let's crane our necks up a little bit, Migs, if we could. As I said, Everton playing Manchester United at the weekend in the BT Sport Saturday lunchtime game. Okay, Brighton are 4 points off the top 4 and unearthed yet another young South American player. But really, are we looking at the top 4 places really being between, obviously, you know, the top 2 are away, Manchester United, Newcastle and Spurs? And I'm assuming, everyone assumes, that Spurs are going to be the ones who miss out.
Well, given that Brighton can go ahead of Spurs if they win the 2 games in hand, I actually think we have to put Brighton in there now. I mean, it would be a stretch to see them do it, especially given the point situation with Newcastle and Manchester United. But basically, at the moment, there's a better outlook to them than Spurs. They're exciting to watch. They take again, they've got. I mean, even allowing for Harry Kane kind of being the guarantee of goals that he is, Brighton have more points of attack. They're not so dependent on one striker, and that's even allowing for the kind of the exciting form of Evan Ferguson. So you wouldn't say they're right in there, but if ever there's a chance for Brighton to qualify for the Champions League, this is it. They could be aided now as well by Manchester United, who it looks like are really feeling the effect of so much football, but it's also kind of going for so many trophies, in that they can still win three in a season that at the moment still feels like it's very kind of open for them and how it could look. I mean, obviously winning the League Cup and claiming that first piece of silverware since 2017 is hugely significant and a landmark, but it will be slightly disappointing if that's all they end up with, especially if they miss out on the Champions League. But certainly, there's a vulnerability to Manchester United right now. And in contrast to Everton, who have that kind of emotional momentum with them, and Brighton have a lot more than emotional momentum with them, there's suddenly that kind of deflation around United right now. I mean, you would think they've got enough quality for things to even, especially with so much football to play. But they need a bit of a spark again, given their form has been so bad since winning that League Cup. Now, the return of Eriksen to the team and Casemiro, who are evidently so important to how that side functions, will be crucial.
Yeah. Now, Chelsea, a club you know well, Dom, that game against Liverpool on Tuesday night, I shudder to think how much money was paid for those players. I've heard estimates around £1 billion for just an absolute amorphous blob of a game. Where are Chelsea going to go, do you think? Because it does seem, even being charitable, that the owners, let's say, are struggling to come to terms with the culture of the game they've bought into. They've got a heck of a fixture list coming up. Arsenal, Manchester City, Manchester United, Newcastle. They've obviously got the little matter of a Champions League quarterfinal against Real Madrid. Did Chelsea know where they're going?
They've obviously taken the bold decision to go back to Frank Lampard to see them through until the end of the season and on an interim basis, which, you know, you might consider quite surprising given that this is a figure that was leaving Everton earlier this season under a bit of a cloud, but and indeed had been sacked by Chelsea back in 2021. However, that in terms of, you know, lancing the toxicity that's been building up at Stamford Bridge, I suppose you could argue that he, you know, returning a club icon back to the fold to oversee the club in a traumatic time, there's a logic to that. Certainly some of the match-going supporters at Chelsea will be pleased to see a familiar face back in the fold, someone that they can identify with, someone that represents Chelsea as far as they're concerned. And I think a bit of familiarity will provide a bit of reassurance at a difficult time. But in terms of the whole wider picture of the culture of the club, I mean, the owners have got to use this period with Lampard in charge to come up with a long-term solution, to come up with an appointment in the summer who is going to take Chelsea on to the next level and is going to be able to cope with some of the issues that Graham Potter struggled with, namely that this is a hugely bloated squad, 40-plus professionals, and a club that's in transition, a team that's in transition, a team that is struggling to come to terms with the fact that it's not in Premier League contention and next year might not even be competing in Europe. So it's going to be a difficult task, but the owners are learning on the hoof. They've got to hope that their next permanent appointment is the right one because Potter wasn't. And they've got to hope that Frank Lampard is a steadying hand to take them through to the summer. As I say, I think match-going supporters will probably welcome his arrival back at the club.
Mm. If you're Nagelsmann, would you go to Chelsea or would you maybe start winking at Real Madrid?
Well, this is something that's hanging over Chelsea actually a lot, being that two of their main candidates, Nagelsmann and Pochettino, their first choice probably is something hanging over. They both really want Real Madrid. But even that, of course, is dependent on the fact that with Madrid, it sounds like it's 50-50 if Carlo Ancelotti actually goes. So I suppose maybe they can't afford to hang around. But it's interesting, even this kind of managerial, I mean, it's like just tears to it, really. And almost maybe things happening at the wrong time for certain people in certain clubs, in that Spurs obviously acted first and their main, or their, I suppose, top shortlist, or the top end of their shortlist is very similar to Chelsea, but Chelsea suddenly becoming available makes life difficult for Spurs. But then on the other side, if, say, for example, if it was to be confirmed that Ancelotti was to leave, well, that would do to Chelsea what Chelsea have done to Spurs, and that suddenly there's a more available job or more interesting job again, a more attractive job. I put up a story this morning. Luis Enrique is travelling to London. He's someone who wouldn't go to Real Madrid and apparently impressed in initial talks. So I think that is one, from the way people in Spain are talking at least, although I suppose this mirrors how people in Germany were talking, he might have as much of a chance as Nagelsmann. But it does feel like we're in a situation where everyone who kind of does well on an interview will be thinking they're the one, and Chelsea are insistent they're not that close to a decision. But it's actually, whatever about the spinning plates of the wider season, the summer to come, feels like there's a lot of spinning plates to this Chelsea job.
Well, to draw everything together, it's really strange to think, but Romelu Lukaku is still a Chelsea player. He is, in to all intents and purposes, a £97 million afterthought. Now, that's unfair, but it pales into insignificance compared to the treatment that he's receiving in Serie A. It was beyond understanding that he was expected to endure vile racial abuse before, during, and after his successful penalty, which earned Inter a cup draw against Juventus. He celebrated the goal. Well, who wouldn't? And was sent off for it. That's unbelievable. The response of many in Italian football was to shrug and change the subject. Lukaku is an intelligent, well-read, highly professional athlete. He has every right to feel betrayed. Frankly, his teammates should have walked off with him. In the meantime, I'd just like to thank Sean Dyche for his time, and thanks also to Miguel and Dominic for their insights.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.